And now, a man who campaigned against Barack Obama in all 57 states, Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I am Mark Gillar. Our very special guest today is Christopher Conover. He is a research scholar in the Center for Health Policy and Inequalities Research at the Global Health Institute at Duke University. He also is an adjunct scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He received his PhD in policy analysis from the Party Rand Graduate School. He's here today to talk to us about his book, American Health Economy Illustrated. Mr. Conover, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Tell me what you think about Obamacare being upheld by the Supreme Court. What's your take on the decision? Did it surprise you?
Well, it did surprise me. I think it surprised nearly everyone. But I never expected the court's decision to resolve the political battle over health reform. We can all agree that health reform is needed, but the misguided Obama health plan is really deeply flawed, and it needs to be replaced even if it's technically constitutional. So I was encouraged that the court ruled that the individual mandate was an unconstitutional exercise of the Commerce Clause, and that threatening to take away the state's existing Medicaid funds if they don't expand their programs was an unconstitutionally coercive move by Congress. And four members of the court did vote to strike down the entire law, but unfortunately that's not a majority. So now it's squarely in the hands of voters to select policymakers who can champion a more patient-centered approach to reform.
What do you think about the people that are saying that while the rest of us are playing checkers, Justice Roberts is playing chess, and that by deeming this a tax, he's giving the Republicans something they can use to battle Obama in November, and that there was also the thing that because it's a tax, it should have the bill should have originated in the House. The House bill hit a roadblock in the Senate, and the Senate took their own bill and of course it ended up being passed by reconciliation. Some people are saying that if this is a tax, it was never legally passed. What have you heard about that, and what's your take on it?
Well, on the latter point, that they're technically incorrect. That is, the House voted first in October, and then the Senate voted in December. But the bill that the Senate voted on was actually a bill that was passed by the House that had nothing to do with health reform. They literally stripped the entire language out of that bill and then substituted the language of the health reform law in its place. So, you know, it followed the technical requirements of the bill originating in the House. It may have, violated the spirit of the Constitution in terms of that, but that kind of Mickey Mouse is done all the time, unfortunately.
Yeah, someone told me, actually, I remember who it was. It was Judge James Rogan, who, of course, was one of the people in the House that was going after Clinton during the impeachment trials, and he's a judge in California now, and he said that this particular bill has over 400 issues that are impacted that have nothing to do with health care, and it's almost hard to call it a health care bill. I mean, it federalizes the student loan program and does all kinds of things that actually have nothing to do with health care. But one of the things it does that I found really interesting, Chris, is that it stopped the expansion of numerous physician-owned hospitals that were expanding across the country and prevented the building of any new physician-owned hospitals. I mean, that sounds like a political payoff to some of the corporate hospital chains. I have no idea why that would have been in there.
Well, there were lots of political payoffs in the bill to drug companies and hospitals and all sorts of things. And in that particular provision you're talking about, the sort of the moratorium on specialty hospital expansion is not a good idea. I mean, those specialty hospitals actually are a positive innovation in the healthcare system, because specialty hospitals can be much more efficient at treating cancer or heart disease or whatever condition they're designed to, configured especially to treat. And they can do a much better job in terms of patient outcomes and in terms of the cost of providing that care. So, to try to stop those or slow those down is not good news for trying to control health spending or trying to improve health outcomes. But, yeah, there are lots of payoffs in the bill.
I have a father-in-law who is about to turn 80, and he spent some time in one of those hospitals, and he called it the best hospital experience he'd ever had. You certainly can't argue that the quality of care isn't there in those hospitals. Now, one of the things, Chris, that you point out in the book is that over the last 80 years, our country's expenditure on healthcare has increased by over 25-fold, whereas GDP has only quintupled. Why are we spending so much money on healthcare? Is it just the aging of the baby boomers, or is it something else?
Well, no, it's because of the perverse incentives we've created in the healthcare system, and most of the pathologies of the U.S. health, American health economy, if you will, can be traced back to misguided government policies. So just as an example, since the 1940s, we've had a tax subsidy for employer-provided health coverage. Now, that sounds like a good idea. It makes health coverage more affordable, but what it does in practice is it encourages employers to have much more comprehensive coverage than makes economic sense. You know, employers aren't responsible for homeowners insurance or auto insurance or other forms of insurance. They're only responsible for health insurance, and the reason for that is the average person with a health, an employer-based health plan gets a subsidy of about 30 cents on the dollar. That sounds like a great deal, but what it does is it means that people have an incentive to load as much as they can on their employer health plan, including sort of routine maintenance and prevention expenditures that they ought to be paying for out of their own pocket. Nobody uses their homeowner's insurance to mow their, you know, get their lawn mowing paid for, or use their auto insurance to get gas in their car. And the reason we don't is if you use a third-party payer to pay for that kind of thing, one, it creates perverse incentives. You're not going to have a very strong incentive to price shop for the best price. And two, you may get more extensive services than you really need. Maybe you're going to get your lawn mowed twice a week if a third-party payer pays for it instead of just once a week. And moreover, it's just going to create incentives for overutilization of services. And plus, you're going to add an administrative cost on top of whatever it costs to do all those things. Because, you know, when a third-party payer is paying for it, you have to file a claim with them. They have to process the claim. So just think of that. Even if it's $10 per claim, you know, a $10 add-on to a $30 claim increases the cost of that thing by 33%. That's not very sensible or efficient.
One of the things I noticed, and I worked for 14 years in the pharmaceutical industry for two very large pharma companies, and as you might imagine, I mean, they had great insurance. I had a hernia operation, cost me $20, and that was just for the follow-up visit, the copay for the follow-up visit. I didn't pay anything for the operation, so the insurance was out of this world. And I've noticed that one, there, you point out in the book, I mean, obviously there's certain economies of scale for having these large employer-based policies, but at the same time, there's certain privileges given to these large employers. I mean, yes, they cost less per person because they're economies of scale, but I noticed they do other things. For instance, they look the other way on pre-existing conditions. The pharmacy, the pharmaceutical industry is known for hiring a lot of young women in their mid to late 20s, and you'd be surprised how many times women would join our firms and then announce the next day, by the way, I'm pregnant. And not once did any of them get turned down for medical services because it was a pre-existing condition. Many women, I think, actually seek out the pharmaceutical industry for this reason. You know, if you have a situation where people are being encouraged to, if you will, abuse the system, I think it's going to happen. And as far as what you said about people, you know, not having the incentive to price shop, two quick points. One is that almost everyone I know with insurance, including myself, my family, we're guilty. We run to the doctor every time we have a runny nose. And in the old days, I remember being, you know, I'm almost 50. I remember as a kid, you know, you got a cold, you toughed it out. You didn't go to the doctor until things got really bad. But we've kind of become spoiled in terms of, you know, we run to the doctor for the slightest things now.
Right, and that's not a surprise. I mean, if someone else is paying the bill, you're going to be much less cost conscious. and that's what we have. You could replicate the pathologies of the American health economy in almost any other part of the economy by introducing third-party payment, right? If I told you I was going to pay for 90 cents of every dollar of groceries you put in your shopping cart, I guarantee you what you put in your shopping cart is going to be way more expensive, and you're not going to really care about the prices of stuff.
Well, you know, speaking of that, one of the things that I've noticed is that if you look at things that are routinely not covered by insurance, things like breast augmentation, hair restoration, various types of plastic, cosmetic stuff. Those things have fallen through the floor price-wise, but things that are covered by insurance have continued to rise. What does that say about how insurance interferes with the free market?
Well, that's a great example of it's proof positive that markets actually can work in medicine, and in the areas of medicine where we allow them to work, markets work exactly as advertised. Prices go down, quality goes up. That's what we see in every other market, including for LASIK surgery and cosmetic surgery and the various things that aren't covered by third-party payers. And the reverse is true once you introduce third-party payment, unfortunately. And I'm not arguing against insurance entirely. I mean, we need insurance coverage, but what we need it for is for catastrophic coverage.
Yes.
And we could all have universal catastrophic coverage for much, much less expense than we're now squandering on very comprehensive third-party coverage for lots of things that you really don't need insurance for.
What do you make, Chris, of the argument, and I hear this a lot from the left, that people that are uninsured get all their services through emergency rooms, and therefore we're paying for it already?
Well, that's true to an extent, although the extent was greatly exaggerated by progressives. I mean, the actual impact of a typical uninsured person on the rest of us is 20 cents a day at the upper end, and a more realistic estimate is maybe 6 cents a day. Now, that's not a very big problem. I mean, that's a problem measured in $10 or $12 billion a year. So it made no sense to have a $1 trillion overhaul of our healthcare system to deal with a $10 billion problem. But that's what Obamacare did.
Well, you called it a $1 trillion. I'm hearing it estimated as high as $1.4 trillion. And if I'm not mistaken, the Congressional Budget Office is, you know, essentially saying that the thing is going to cost twice what we were originally told. The government never delivers anything under a budget. So.
So when we get back, I want to hear your opinion on what this bureaucratic monster is going to cost us in the long run. We'll be right back with Christopher Conover right after this message.
Hi, I'm Brian Brody. Have you ever lost your power and simply wanted to flip a switch to turn your lights back on? If so, this message is the most important you will ever hear, because there's never been a better time to get off the grid and generate your own supply of electrical power. Solar power generators are now available. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving electrical power when you need it most. Unlike gas generators, a solar generator runs quietly, emits no fumes, and produces electricity from the sun. It's like running an electric power plant in your own home. Hurricanes, ice storms, brownouts, blackouts, you'll never suffer through painful power outages again.
And if you'd like to learn how you can get a solar generator for your family, just go to teapartypowerhour.com and click on the appropriate ad. While you're there, you'll also see ads for solar ovens, extended life light bulbs, and life-saving survival food packets.
Are you worried about the economy? Have you ever wondered if the politicians and the bankers are going to bring the whole thing crashing down? If so, pay close attention. Because in an economic meltdown, non-hybrid seeds could become more valuable than even silver and gold. After all, securing a source of food for your family is the single most important thing you can do. Introducing the Survival Seed Bank, the perfect mix of germination-tested non-hybrid seeds. You get enough seeds to plant a full-acre crisis garden that can produce an endless supply of nutrient-dense food for you and your family. And the best part is that these seeds have not been genetically modified in any way. Remember, in a real economic crisis, non-hybrid seeds are the ultimate barter item. Prepare your family today.
Prepare your family today by going to teapartypowerhour.com and clicking on the ad for the Survival Seed Bank. Now, while you're there, you're going to see ads for a lot of other products that can help your family in the event of a disaster, whether the disaster is government-made or natural. You're going to see ads for things like solar-powered ovens, solar-powered electrical supplies, and freeze-dried food that can provide your family with immediate nutrition in the event of an economic meltdown. Once again, the place to go is teapartypowerhour.com. And we are back at the Tea Party Power Hour. My guest is Christopher Conover. He is the author of American Health Economy Illustrated. Chris, we were just talking about the fact that Obamacare is very unlikely to come in under budget. What are your estimates of what this bureaucratic monster, this Leviathan, if you will, is going to cost the American taxpayer?
I mean, the trillion was the original price, the advertised price tag. Everyone knew that, you know, basically they were trying to stuff a $2.7 trillion plan into a $1 trillion package, if you will. I mean, when you count the cost not only on the government, but the fact that all these mandates were going to increase the cost of health insurance for people, you know, the fully loaded cost of Obamacare is much, much higher than $1 trillion.
So where does the money eventually come from? Because I'm concerned about Obamacare, and I've also been told to push the baby boomers, you know, through Social Security and through Medicare is going to cost over $100 trillion. We quite frankly just don't have the money. In fact, as the baby boomers age, there's going to be a huge shortfall there. So, I mean, the money just isn't there. So how do you see this playing out?
Well, that's what really concerns me. The Congressional Budget Office in its latest long-term projections says that the federal government over the next 75 years is going to increase in size relative to the economy by nearly 50%. Every single penny of that increase in the size of government can be attributed to tax-financed health entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, and the new subsidies that are going to be provided under Obamacare in the exchanges. Now, I don't know anyone who is interested in seeing their federal taxes go up by nearly 50% to pay for all these entitlements. But rather than solve this problem, Obamacare essentially diverted $500 billion of resources out of the Medicare program, which is already underfunded, and it used those to spend them on a new entitlement for the uninsured. So the analogy I give is, imagine if your roof was leaking and threatened to eventually flood your whole house. You get a loan from the bank, and instead of fixing your roof, you build a new garage, right? Does that make any sense? But that's essentially what Obamacare did, and I'm very concerned about the long-term fiscal health and, you know, the sort of the unconscionable debt that we're handing off to our children and grandchildren. That doesn't make me feel good.
Well, Mitch McConnell is already telling people, get used to it. It's not going to go away. Do you hold out any hope that, you know, through a change in administration and perhaps Republicans taking over the Senate and maintaining control of the House, that we might eventually see this dismantled?
Well, the only hope is a change of administration. I mean, Obama clearly has no incentive to try to dismantle this misguided law. But there's only a narrow window of opportunity. I mean, if we don't get it done this election, then I think it's game over for the healthcare system, because once this law is embedded, you know, all the tens of thousands of pages of regulation are implemented, there's really not going to be any plausible way of extracting it. You know, we've had Medicare on the books for more than 50 years. It's a very flawed plan. Has lots of you know, perverse incentives in it, and we've tried to fiddle with it and try to fix it for all those years, and we haven't been successful. So why we think we're going to do any better with the government trying to micromanage the entire health economy is really beyond me. So we, you know, if voters are the Supreme Court basically didn't save us, right? And now it's up to the voters to save ourselves from this misguided law.
Do you see this as electrifying the Republican base to actually get out and vote more so than we would have?
Um, Well, among the deep base, I think so. What I'm really not clear on is the independents. The independents tend to be slightly less favorable towards the law than Democrats, certainly. But, you know, I just don't know how many are going to say, well, the Supreme Court decided and what they say goes, and therefore let's just stop whining and get on with implementation. I think that the Republicans really need to educate the public about just how bad this law is. You know, going back to one of your earlier points, just the medical device tax that's going to be imposed next year, it's 2.3% on their gross revenues, not on their profits, but on their gross revenues, is going to have a very severe impact on medical innovation. And I just saw a study that came out the other day that estimates that it's going to increase, it's going to, we're going to lose 1 million life years due to higher mortality because of the innovation that won't happen under Obamacare because of this medical tax. I mean, basically, when we tax the medical device industries, what we're going to get is less research and development to get more innovative products that save our lives down the road. And that's, you know, that's, we'll never even see those adverse effects. You know, those are the kinds of subtle effects, but very dramatic adverse consequences that can result from this law. And, the sooner the public understands this, and especially the independents, the higher the prospects that they'll go to the polls and get an electoral outcome we need.
As someone who was in pharma for 14 years, two quick points. I was in sales, and so we believe in giving doctors the WIFM, the what's in it for me, when we would go into an office. If a product was such that, you know, they would require less follow-up or whatever, we'd make sure to tell the doctor not just how the drug benefited the patient, but how the drug benefited the doctor as well. Now, if you tell all these young voters out there that they're about to pay through the nose for their tanning bed, that might be something they'll listen to. And on a more serious note, what you said about the lack of innovation, right now, for the last 2 years, the pharmaceutical industry has been laying off employees like crazy. And a lot of people said, oh, that's because Obamacare is coming and all this kind of stuff. No, this actually dates back to the mere proposal of Hillary Care during the Clinton administration. If you go back and look at the books of all the major pharmaceutical companies operating in the U.S. at that time, the first thing they did, to your point, is slash R&D, and that drought in all the major pipelines, including Pfizer, you know, which was once, you know, the untouchable, you know, darling of Wall Street. Even Pfizer has a drought in their pipeline right now, and the drought that can be seen there and at Merck and at GA, all these other companies, is due to the mere proposal of Hillary Care. Because if you look at how long it takes for a drug to go from its inception to market, that's where we are right now, is what, you know, the R&D slashes back during the Clinton administration are impacting us now. I can't even begin to imagine if the mere threat of Hillary Care did this to the pharmaceutical industry, what's going to happen 25 years from now. It's the lack of innovation. In fact, the numbers you gave me underestimate it. I mean, seriously, it's that bad. Because pharmaceutical companies, like all other major corporations, think short term. They want to make Wall Street happy today. And the way you do that is by cutting things like R&D that's some other manager's problem a couple of decades from now. So I think you're absolutely right. Whether it's medical devices or pharmaceutical, we're going to see a complete lack of innovation. You know, that next Viagra, that next Lipitor, that next whatever. I mean, we're not going to miss it because we're not going to know, but there is going to be an incredible lack of innovation. So I don't know. I don't know how you sell that point to people because, you know, you're talking 20, 25 years down the road, but it's something that everybody needs to consider.
Well, that's what makes me a little bit nervous is we can't be just focused on today, you know, because they front-loaded this thing with the goodies today, right? You know, we're going to expand coverage to 26-year-olds, and we're going to, you know, no cost sharing for prevention and things like that. They want you to focus on those goodies and ignore the, you know, this tsunami of adverse effects in terms of $800 billion in higher taxes and, you know, these adverse effects on innovation. Going to one other industry, the hospital industry, could be devastated by these Medicare cuts. The Medicare actuary actually has projected that in the out years, and we're not talking about just 2 or 3 years, this is more like 10 or 20 years down the road, but nevertheless, if the Obamacare cuts are implemented as advertised or as specified in the law, hospitals will get paid under Medicaid 60 to 80% less than private insurers will pay. Well, needless to say, when we get to that point, hospitals aren't going to be taking, and this is true of doctors as well, okay? So hospitals and doctors are not going to have a very strong incentive to take Medicare patients, or if they do take them, they're going to, you know, the quality of care certainly isn't going to be the same as it is today. So that's something that should scare a lot of seniors. And going back to the young people, the law also, you know, puts restrictions on how premiums are set, and it basically says that you can't charge old people more than 3 times the rate for young people. What that means is that young people are going to pay higher premiums, hundreds or maybe even thousands of dollars higher, in order to cross-subsidize older workers. Well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense from an equity point of view. I mean, young workers are the lowest paid workers. They're the least skilled and least experienced. And older workers, in contrast, have that many more years of experience under their belt. They're typically much higher paid, and therefore they can afford their higher premiums. So to have this cross subsidy going from young, low paid workers to older, high paid workers isn't really fair, and it's certainly not efficient either.
So rather than have the insurance, you know, the way private insurance works, where they look at their actuary tables and look at the expected number of events in an age group and set the premiums based on that, here's a situation where you're openly admitting that you're subsidizing another age group.
Right.
Okay. That alone might be incentive for some young people to get out and vote differently than they did the last time around. Now, I had a letter sent to me by a British citizen who tried to warn me of what was coming in terms of the cutbacks in quality. So I'm going to ask you, when we hear these predictions that there's going to be end-of-life counseling, what Sarah Palin called the death panels, when we hear that there are going to be long waits for operations and we're going to have some of the same problems that we see in socialized countries, what's your take on that? Give us some examples of what we might expect in terms of the drop-off in quality of care once this bill is fully implemented.
Well, let me talk about the aggregate level. I've looked at the comparisons of healthcare spending across countries.
Chris, hold that thought. I apologize, but I'm up against a hard break. We will be right back at the Tea Party Power Hour with Christopher Conover, the author of American Health Economy Illustrated, right after this message.
Hi, I'm Brian Brody. Have you ever lost your power and simply wanted to flip a switch to turn your lights back on? If so, this message is the most important you will ever hear, because there's never been a better time to get off the grid and generate your own supply of electrical power. Solar power generators are now available. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving electrical power when you need it most. Unlike gas generators, a solar generator runs quietly, emits no fumes, and produces electricity from the sun. It's like running an electric power plant in your own home. Hurricanes, ice storms, brownouts, blackouts, you'll never suffer through painful power outages again.
And if you'd like to learn how you can get a solar generator for your family, just go to teapartypowerhour.com and click on the appropriate ad. While you're there, you'll also see ads for solar ovens, extended life light bulbs, and life-saving survival food packets.
Are you worried about the economy? Have you ever wondered if the politicians and the bankers are going to bring the whole thing crashing down? If so, pay close attention. Because in an economic meltdown, non-hybrid seeds could become more valuable than even silver and gold. After all, securing a source of food for your family is the single most important thing you can do.
Introducing the Survival Seed Bank, the perfect mix of germination-tested non-hybrid seeds. You get enough seeds to plant a full-acre crisis garden that can produce an endless supply of nutrient-dense food for you and your family. And the best part is that these seeds have not been genetically modified in any way. Remember, in a real economic crisis, non-hybrid seeds are the ultimate barter item. Prepare your family today.
Prepare your family today by going to TeaPartyPowerHour.com and clicking on the ad for the Survival Seed Bank. Now, while you're there, you're going to see ads for a lot of other products that can help your family in the event of a disaster, whether the disaster is government-made or natural. You're going to see ads for things like solar-powered ovens, solar-powered electrical supplies, and freeze-dried food that can provide your family with immediate nutrition in the event of an economic meltdown. Once again, the place to go is TeaPartyPowerHour.com. And we are back at the Tea Party Power Hour. I'm your host, Mark Gillar. My guest today is Christopher Conover. He is the author of American Health Economy Illustrated. And Chris, right before we went to break, we were discussing what a lot of people are concerned about, and that is the anticipated level of drop-off once Obamacare is fully implemented. I'm talking about the drop-off in medical services. You said that you had done a comparison between the United States and other countries. What conclusions did you draw from that?
What they show is that single payer countries such as Canada and Britain are spending 20% less than you would predict that they would or should, given their level of per capita gross domestic product. Okay, now that suggests that there's a lot of rationing going on. Now, it takes a lot of different forms, and what you've described in the British system is one form. You know, they have a panel that it basically decides what medical procedures are allowed, and any medical procedure that costs more than $50,000 per added year of life, they won't pay for. Now, to give you one example, we pay for kidney dialysis under the Medicare program right now. Mm-hmm. And the typical basically when you're doing dialysis, every year you're doing dialysis, you're keeping a patient alive that otherwise would have died, okay? The cost of dialysis these days is $75,000 to $80,000. So, you know, if you use the British system's criterion, we wouldn't even be paying for dialysis for those patients because it's too expensive. It exceeds the threshold that they use for cutting off what's allowed to be paid for by their national health system. Now, that feature is not in Obamacare right now. What is in Obamacare is this IPAB, this independent advisory board for Medicare, that it's a 15, you know, these are unelected individuals, they're appointed positions. And they're supposed to make annual recommendations to keep Medicare spending below a certain cost target. Mm-hmm. And Congress can only override the IPAB if it gets with a 60% vote. So it's got to have a supermajority in both houses in order to override any IPAB recommendation. That's giving an extraordinary amount of power to a bunch of unelected individuals. You know, we don't know how this is going to play out. I mean, they're not allowed to cut benefits or cut eligibility. They're not allowed to select procedures that are going to be paid for. Most of their power is simply to ratchet down on payment rates to providers, which is going to have very adverse effects on access. But that's the IPAB as it's configured now. As we go down the road and we realize that Obamacare is costing way more than we ever expected, and as the cost pressures rise on the federal budget, I'm concerned that, you know, once that mechanism is in place, all that Congress has to do is pass another law that just gradually over time expands the power of the IPAB to start getting into some of these, you know, very important clinical decisions, and starts substituting its judgment for the judgment of doctors. I think that's almost inevitable if we keep on the path that we're on, if we implement Obamacare in full.
Now, one of the things that scared me just as around the time that all this was starting to be proposed were some of the comments coming out of the left. I mean, Tom Daschle said that old people need to learn to grow old and die with dignity. We had Rahm Emanuel's brother Zeke showing this graph that essentially demonstrated that people under the age of 3 and over the age of 65 didn't really deserve medical services because they weren't of that great a value to society. Even Barack Obama himself said, you know, we may have to give grandma a pain pill. And I can recall watching liberal doctors on television saying we consume, which is true, we consume most of our medical expenses in the latter years of our life, and we just can't go on misallocating resources this way. Of course, I don't think any of them were talking about themselves and what they're going to do at that stage of life.
Right.
But when you hear some of the rather cold interpretations of our healthcare system and the way things should be coming out of the left, it should have been enough to scare most people about this from the get-go. What's your take on how people are eventually going to be treated? Are we eventually going to evolve into this cold society where we expect elderly people to grow old and die with dignity? And if somebody's, you know, if a baby's 1 or 2 or 3 and they're born with all types of dysfunctions, they might look at them and say, well, this is going to be a poor quality of life, so what's the point in saving it? I mean, are we going to eventually see panels, appointed panels, making those kinds of decisions?
Well, that's conceivable. The Medicaid program addresses the most vulnerable group in society. That's poor people with, you know, pretty bad health conditions, old people, disabled people with low incomes. What's interesting about the Medicaid program is it's been underfunded for decades. And what I mean by that is when you compare Medicaid people on Medicaid to people who are uninsured, people on Medicaid actually are more likely to use the emergency room than people who are uninsured completely. And the reason for that is because our payment rates for providers under Medicaid are very, very low. And most providers, or many providers, more than half of primary care docs, for example, don't take Medicaid patients because they don't get paid enough or the red tape is too much to deal with. So if that's how we're treating the most vulnerable members of society, and, you know, Medicaid is fully tax-financed, that doesn't bode well for, you know, once we introduce tax subsidies, once we try to get everyone under this umbrella of tax finance care, it just doesn't bode well for the rest of us. I think rationing ultimately is inevitable because, remember, healthcare is competing with lots of other priorities. I mean, once you politicize healthcare, now you've got to pit healthcare against, you know, what are we going to spend on defense? What are we going to spend on criminal justice? What are we going to spend on education? And you're going to have politicians making those trade-offs instead of letting individual citizens decide for themselves, well, how much do I want to spend on my healthcare versus education for my children or, you know, whatever other priorities people have in their lives. You know, as long as it's a decentralized, market-oriented system, patients are in control of those trade-offs. As soon as you elevate it to a more centralized system, the way Obamacare is designed to be, now you're basically delegating all that decision-making authority to politicians, and I'm not particularly optimistic about how those decisions are going to get played out over the long term.
Gee, I can't understand why, Chris. Now, one of the things that the left has been trying to sell us on for a while is that we do not have that great a system. Michael Moore went to Cuba and came back concluding that the Cubans have better health care than Americans. And we see a lot of cherry picking going on. You know, this country has a lower cancer rate, and this country has a lower heart attack rate, and this country has a lower whatever rate. And it seems to me like there's some cherry picking going on. There's some apple to oranges comparisons going on. But in your opinion, based on all your research, Mr. Conover, where does our system rank? Are we one of the better healthcare systems in the world?
Yes, absolutely. And just let me give you an example. On life expectancy, we rank low on raw life expectancy. But once you adjust those figures, as I think you should, for violent deaths, that is deaths due to auto accidents and homicides and suicides, we have more of those deaths in the United States than in other countries for a variety of reasons. But they have nothing to do with medical care. So once you back out those numbers that have nothing to do with medical care, the residual life expectancy, we're number one among major European countries in life expectancy, which is a very different picture than the picture that Michael Moore and other critics of the system would give you.
I'm sorry, I can't even hear his name without laughing. I remember when he did the movie Sicko, he was crashing drug rep dinner programs and trying to get his cameras in the door, and his people would be screaming, this is a public restaurant, and restaurant owners would have to say, it's a privately owned business. That room has been rented for a private party, and you're not on the guest list. But and he was also they also hired doctors to try to get drug reps to make mistakes, and they were putting up hidden cameras in offices. In fact, I'm in Texas, and there was actually a doctor in Bastrop, Texas, who had one of the cameras hidden in his office, and it was so obvious to the reps going in because he would ask ridiculous questions like, so tell me the indications for your drug again. It's ridiculous. So every time I hear Michael Moore's name, I just crack up laughing. From a common sense standpoint, even not knowing everything you just said, the world leaders fly to America for medical care. People from other countries fly to America. I've never heard of any Americans flying to Great Britain or flying to Cuba for medical care.
So just think about it. One of the leading advocates of single-payer health care was Senator Ted Kennedy. When he needed life-saving brain surgery, he lived in Massachusetts right next door to Canada. He didn't fly to Canada. He came down to Duke University Medical Center. The premier of Newfoundland flew out of Canada to the United States to get, heart surgery or brain surgery or something. But the point is, he didn't stay within his own country, even though it obviously would have been way less expensive, much more convenient, whatever. He went to where the medical care is the best, and that's the United States.
Absolutely. And I've always believed if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And again, to your earlier point, that's not to say that some reform wasn't necessary. For instance, tort reform would have been nice. Allowing insurance companies to sell across state lines would have been great. Those types of reforms are nowhere to be found in the Affordable Health Care Act, are they?
No, they're not. And really, we need reform of Medicare and Medicaid and this tax exclusion that the federal government provides for employer-based coverage is crazy in terms of its design. We could have a much more efficient and equitable approach to subsidizing private health insurance if that's what we want to do. But Obamacare didn't touch any of those major reforms. What it did is just expand a broken system, if you will.
Chris, in the short time we have left, tell the folks at home how they can get a copy of your book, American Health Economy Illustrated.
They can go over to AEI.org and they can find blog posts that I've written there and links to the book and all of that.
And again, that's all the time we have. It's been an absolute pleasure having you here today. Very, very informative. And we'd love to have you back sometime, Chris.
I'd be happy to do it. I enjoyed it. Thanks so much, Mark.
I did as well. Thank you.
And we'll be right back after this message with Edwin Fulmer. He is the president of the Heritage Foundation and the author of a new book entitled The American Spirit.
Hi, I'm Brian Brody. Have you ever lost your power and simply wanted to flip a switch to turn your lights back on? If so, this message is the most important you will ever hear, because there's never been a better time to get off the grid and generate your own supply of electrical power. Solar power generators are now available. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving electrical power when you need it most. Unlike gas generators, a solar generator runs quietly, emits no fumes, and produces electricity from the sun. It's like running an electric power plant in your own home. Hurricanes, ice storms, brownouts, blackouts, you'll never suffer through painful power outages again.
And if you'd like to learn how you can get a solar generator for your family, just go to teapartypowerhour.com and click on the appropriate ad. While you're there, you'll also see ads for solar ovens, extended life light bulbs, and life-saving survival food packets.
Are you worried about the economy? Have you ever wondered if the politicians and the bankers are going to bring the whole thing crashing down? If so, pay close attention. Because in an economic meltdown, non-hybrid seeds could become more valuable than even silver and gold. After all, securing a source of food for your family is the single most important thing you can do. Introducing the Survival Seed Bank, the perfect mix of germination-tested non-hybrid seeds. You get enough seeds to plant a full-acre crisis garden that can produce an endless supply of nutrient-dense food for you and your family. And the best part is that these seeds have not been genetically modified in any way. Remember, in a real economic crisis, non-hybrid seeds are the ultimate barter item. Prepare your family today.
Prepare your family today by going to teapartypowerhour.com and clicking on the ad for the Survival Seed Bank. Now, while you're there, you're going to see ads for a lot of other products that can help your family in the event of a disaster, whether the disaster is government-made or natural. You're going to see ads for things like solar-powered ovens, solar-powered electrical supplies, and freeze-dried food that can provide your family with immediate nutrition in the event of an economic meltdown. Once again, the place to go is teapartypowerhour.com. And we are back at the Tea Party Power Hour. My guest is Dr. Ed Fulmer. He is the co-author, along with Brian Tracy, of a book entitled The American Spirit, Celebrating the Virtues and Values That Make Us Great. Dr. Fulmer, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Mark, and to be able to talk directly to all of our Tea Party friends all over the country.
Of course, you are the president of the Heritage Foundation, considered Washington's leading public policy think tank, and you've been the author of 6 books, including Getting America Right. It is an honor to have you here today, and I like the idea that we're going to be talking about American exceptionalism. Before we dive into that, let me just play a little clip from our current president regarding his thoughts on American exceptionalism, and then we'll sort of use that as the backdrop as we go forward.
I believe in American exceptionalism, just as I suspect that the Brits believe in British exceptionalism and the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism.
My take on that is he was kind of saying there's really no such thing as American exceptionalism. Everybody's proud of the country they live in. What's your take on that quote?
Well, my first take is, sure am glad I'm not a Greek right now. I don't think I particularly want to be exceptional in terms of the dive to the bottom. But he just doesn't get it, Mark. I'm sorry, he doesn't. The neat thing about America is that it brings together people from 195 countries here who come here by free choice, who have every opportunity then to climb up and be whatever they can be and do whatever they can do. And that's what makes America so different. They're not bound up by a class system or a caste system or something that's determined by their grandparents in terms of you're going to be down on the farm forever or you're going to be working in a machine shop forever. And nothing wrong with doing those things if that's what you want to do. But you're opportunities are unlimited in America, and that's what makes, I think, America so exceptional.
You know, I've always felt that the Tea Party doesn't like big government, but the Tea Party loves America, and that's why it's always so concerning to me when I see the Occupy Wall Street types, holding up their signs and so forth, that aren't so much protesting the American big government, but instead don't seem to like America at all. What's your take on this group of people that somehow seem to not think very much of America or American exceptionalism?
Look, there are always going to be some dissidents out there, and I guess in some respects, we as real believers in freedom have to say, yeah, they can do their own thing. But the thing about America is that the overwhelming majority of the American people are on our side. They believe in freedom. They believe in individual responsibility, in faith. They believe in limited government. They believe that there should be a rule of law. And, you know, there are some times, frankly, when these occupiers say something that makes sense. Boy, this whole idea of crony capitalism, for example, that just goes against me. It goes against, I'm sure, every Tea Partier. We believe in the rule of law, and the rule of law means everybody's treated the same. So, you know, there are some things where I just don't think they quite understand what the real issues are. They've kind of come to the right conclusion the wrong way. But most of the time, they're just off base, and they don't understand what real opportunities they have.
I think you're right. To me, it seemed like a group of brats who didn't realize how good we have it in America. But, you know, when you look at this group and then try to compare it to the Tea Party, I find it very interesting that so many people in the media portrayed the Tea Party as a dangerous group. You know, you go to a Tea Party, you see grandparents and little kids waving flags and people just wanting a return to a smaller government, less taxes, and somehow that's supposed to be dangerous. I mean, we've got the Department of Homeland Security putting out memos to watch out for returning vets and Tea Partiers and retired law enforcement. And at the same time, when you look at the number of actual murders, rapes, and other assorted crimes committed at Occupy Wall Street, that was kind of a pretty dangerous group. I mean, in fact, you know, as time has gone on, it's kind of degenerated into a bunch of homeless people, I think. How do you sort out what's going on with the media and how they portray the Tea Party versus how they portrayed or actually praised Occupy Wall Street?
Oh, Mark, first thing I do is every morning I'd thank the Lord for people like you who are telling the other side of the story out there, because so much of the mainstream media just they just don't get it. I don't know it's why they quite don't get it. Blame some of it, I think, on our educational system. Blame it on them going to the same cocktail parties on the Upper East Side in Manhattan or whatever. But yeah, today's Washington Times has a front page story about the Occupy group now appearing before the U.S. Judges here in the District of Columbia, because they tried to erect a 25-foot building on public lands at McPherson Square. Well, my gosh, we at Heritage here, we've got a wonderful headquarters building. But if I tried to put up a 25-foot addition on it without getting building permits, just doing it on my own, on my property, not on government property, boy, they'd have me in the slammer in 10 minutes. And these guys are, you know, they're talking about their human rights being violated and all the rest of this stuff. I think you said it before very well when you said they don't know what opportunities they have and what they should really be grateful for.
Well, you know, I can't pretend, and I'm not going to try, that I've gone through the hardships that my parents went through, or my grandparents, or my great-grandparents. Every generation of our family has done a little bit better. That's what America is all about. You know, you go out there and you study hard and you get a good education, and then you do everything you can to prepare your children for school and help them be even more successful academically and in their careers than you were. I mean, that whole building process of each generation moving a little, you know, farther down the line and having a little more success, to me, that's what America is all about. So, you know, when I see groups like this, and then you see the, you know, the Bill Ayers and the Francis Fox, you know, Pivens of the world, you know, going in and talking to them about the need to tear down America and rebuild it in their Marxist utopian, idealistic dream. I just don't get it. I don't understand what they don't like about America, because as you state, America truly is an exceptional place, and it really goes back to the forward thinking of our founding fathers, doesn't it?
Oh, it certainly does. And when you talk about the opportunities you and I have had because of our parents, grandparents, and going back, and you stop with great grandparents. That's when mine came over, landed at Ellis mm-hmm. Island from southern Germany, and made their way out to Chicago. And you know, I remember growing up and hearing those stories. And so now here I am. I've got grandchildren, and what am I giving them? Well, at the moment, I'm giving each one of them a $200,000 mortgage. with no house attached, because each one of them is going to inherit $200,000 worth of debt from Linda and my generation that we're racking up here with the federal government. Well, hey, this is not the kind of thing that we ought to be leaving to the next generation. We've got to do much better than that. We can't be stealing from our grandkids because Bill Ayers and Saul Alinsky have decided that they want to do redistribution down here.
Have you seen that recent – I'm so glad you brought this point up. Have you seen that recent graph that's being put out by Team Obama where he claims that he's added less to the federal deficit than any president in recent times?
I really have. And of course, the only thing was he left out all the spending for the stimulus in the whole first year of his being in office. And you know, that does kind of change the whole trend line a little bit there as we move ahead. And again, when I talk to my friends in the Tea Party movement around the country, last week I was out in Chicago. CPAC Chicago had a conference out there. Largest conservative activist gathering in Chicago in the last 30 years was, I think, 400 about 5 or 6 years ago. This time they had more than 2,000. Half the people there were under age 25, and it was so great. And you know, the number of them had constitutions in their pocket, and they were talking about the great ideas that they're getting from different organizations, including ours, and the ability to communicate through talk radio, through people like you, Mark. I guess that's why I'm such a congenital optimist. Yeah, I've read Saul Alinsky. I know what his plans are. And frankly, I don't underestimate what these guys in the White House have in mind either. But the American people are a very resilient people. They take responsibility. They're basically optimistic about the future. And that's what we wanted to bring out in this book.
You know, it's interesting to me when we go back to that graph that Team Obama has put out, that unfortunately there are people in America who are going to buy into that. And one of the things, and you mentioned Saul Alinsky, one of the things you have to give the left credit for, Dr. Fulmer, is they've sort of taken over the educational system, and I mean from pre-K through grad school. And because of that, and along with their control of the media as well as the entertainment industry, they have an enormous voice to put forward those types of ideas, whether they're right or wrong. And of course, you mentioned Saul Alinsky. It really doesn't matter if they're right or wrong. How did they manage to seize control of these institutions?
You know, you have to go back just about 100 years to the start of the progressive movement, Woodrow Wilson, and what he was trying to do politically, building on Teddy Roosevelt. But at the same time, you're absolutely, you put your finger right on it. It was John Dewey and what he was doing to our education system. You know, we hear now, I just get so exasperated. There are so many different fronts that we have to fight these battles on.
Once again, the name of the book is The American Spirit, Celebrating the Virtues and Values That Make Us Great. We'll throw a link up to it on our website. I assume it's available wherever good books are sold?
It is indeed. Thomas Nelson's our publisher, and Brian Tracy and I are just hoping that people will not only buy it and just kind of look at it, but keep it for years and years, because it's the kind of thing where you can take a chapter and read it to your grandchildren and talk to future generations about why we should be optimistic and what America is really all about.
Dr. Fulmer, it's been an honor having you here today. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed it. We don't have enough people out there saying the kind of things you've said today and saying the kind of things that you and Brian Tracy say in your book. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mark.
Have a great day, sir.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillard.